Greetings from Soundography, a crash course in music, one band at a time. I'm Brian Ebbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And welcome to a special episode of You Gotta Listen to This, where we take a recommendation from somebody about an album that we just need to listen to, or in this case, listen to again, revisit, which I was really excited to do. Hammond, tell us about our special guest.
So our guest today is a guy named Kim Simpson, and I've been friends with Kim since 1992. And he just released an album of covers that I thought that you, Brian, would be very interested in. And then throughout the conversation, we decided to have Kim join us. He lives in Austin now. He does, you know, radio stuff, and he's written a book. So, Kim, how you doing?
Doing all right. Thanks for having me on. Good being with you guys.
It's our pleasure. And before we even talk about the album that you brought for us to listen to, I do want to talk about your brand new album, which, you know, Hammond, I'm sure told you that I'm a covers guy. So I love seeing covers, especially when the artist reimagines things and does something new, which you've absolutely done on Before I Melt Away. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
And can I say, as a massive Squeeze fan, the fact that you've covered a Difford and Tilbrook song, a song from their solo album, and not even Love's Crashing Waves, not the one that everybody covers from that album. You went deep, which right. I love.
Thank you. I'm glad you appreciate that.
I really do.
You know, yeah. I enjoyed kind of digging out these. I guess they were lesser known songs. They were in my head, but I realize now that I've put the album out, a lot of people are, oh, an album maybe just album of 80s covers. I don't know that song. I wondered if I should have just gone all hits, but I was happiest doing it this way.
When you do an album like this, you'll enjoy it, and the end result, I think, is always going to be better doing covers that you love rather than doing the covers that you think are going to please the audience. So, you know, not going straight to Mayor of Simpleton or Senses Working Overtime for XTC or Heaven 17, Let's All Make a Bomb, which was from a Greenpeace tribute album, if I remember correctly.
What's that?
They used it for Greenpeace.
Did they use that for a Greenpeace album? You might be right.
They did, yeah. Or at least that's where I first heard it. So it's great. It's so great to hear some of it. Yeah.
And it feels a little weird doing a song like that because we have increasing reasons to, small scale bombs have gotten very scary in our time.
Yeah.
But that comes from a time when the bomb was on everybody's minds. And so I felt a wee bit subversive doing that song, but, it reaches into the sarcasm and the fears of the time. So I went with it and it just seemed to be working all right. And I think the only two songs on that album that were actually hits in any context were Berlin's The Metro, which did make the radio. And a lot of people remember now.
I was on a Paris train. I emerged in London rain and you were waiting there, swimming through apologies. I remember searching for the perfect words. I was hoping you might change your mind.
Let's talk about the album that you brought for us to listen to.
All right. Well,
and
I picked Elevator by The Rollers, 1979.
That explains something. What song is it? Is it Instant Replay?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like it has the same bass line as I Was Made for Loving You.
It's similar.
Instant Replay. I know. It's the same. It's the same era. So, yeah, of course it's going to sound the same.
Yeah, and it's actually called Instant Relay.
Oh, Instant Relay. Okay, yeah.
Relay. Right.
Well, yeah, and a lot of bands were doing that kind of it's hard to know if they were taking cues from any specific song because that boom, 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 boom bass line was, everywhere at the time. And even in the midst of the Disco Sucks era, it was creeping into all of these these rock songs, like Kiss was doing it, and the Kinks were doing their song Superman had disco bass. And the Rolling Stones, of course, were diving headlong into disco.
Emotional Rescue. And
Paul McCartney was doing disco. So all the rock icons were very eagerly adopting disco sounds. You could hear it in The Who. And nonetheless, there was a Disco Sucks movement happening.
right.
So it's when you look back and you see that it was all kind of mishmashed and silly in a lot of ways, and it ended up having kind of a more of a racial overtone to it, or a gender overtone, I don't know, more than a musical overtone. But it's true that disco was kind of hammering into everybody's psyche at the time, but a lot of the best disco was coming out in 79. So anyway, I'm going off on a tangent.
No, we love that on this show. Yeah, I mean, it really shows you how the producers and really the record companies had more of an influence on the music than I think we'd like to think sometimes, right? Because I'm sure the Rolling Stones probably fought against doing Emotional Rescue and the other, like, I think that was the big disco sounding song for them, the hit out of that era.
Well, I think before that was Miss You, which was disco based.
That's right. Miss You.
Yeah. And I would think that Mick Jagger was wanting to get in on it. I don't know if they were fighting. Maybe Keith Richards was, but you know, the Grateful Dead were all over disco. Mickey Hart adored disco. Checking out all the bars in the mezzanine. And a lot of the best Dead stuff in 77, which is considered their best live year, they were doing disco. They were doing disco a lot. If you listen to Shakedown Street and you listen to their version of Dancing in the Streets, the celebrated live version, they're playing disco. And they're embracing it, and they're reveling in it. Yet it's considered by these Deadheads to be their glorious era. So, yeah. And then the new wave movement after disco was basically UK-ified disco. So it never really went away. It just became this, it had to be totally reframed and redigested. And it came back stronger than ever in the 80s, if you listen.
And so much of that came from, like, the sound Nile Rodgers was putting out. He basically brought so many of those new wave artists from disco into new wave. Yeah.
And that's so subversive of him, because he was at the forefront of the disco sucks, you know, the music he was making. I've read his autobiography, and he talks about that being, oh no, this music that I built my career on is having a backlash. And, you know, disco sucks. And there was the big riot in Comiskey Park. And
the burning of the albums and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But then it's so funny that he was secretly the one who was doing Madonna recordings and stuff, and he was keeping disco alive just in a completely disguised way. It's really something else.
Yeah, Duran, and yeah, so many bands.
He was all over the sounds of the early 80s, and the whole decade. He was really keeping basically his disco heritage alive and well. Financially successful, you know. Disco.
And it worked, because those are some of the most beloved songs in that era, were ones that he had. And you'd hear people say they love those songs, but that they don't like disco in the same breath. And it would be totally almost hypocritical in the fact that they like them, but they hate one and love the other.
When you boil it all down and you get past the industry aspect of disco, when you boil it all the way down, it gets into a racial thing, which is kind of icky. So I don't know. I never have been comfortable joining the Disco Sucks bandwagon, because I don't think it sucked. I loved it as a kid, but I got tired of always hearing Donna Summer hits when I wanted to hear Cheap Trick, you know. Van Halen and Cheap Trick were having this great moment in 79 and their early kind of stages. And it was tiring hearing the disco songs, but it's the same way that it's tiring hearing any hits today or in any other era over and over again.
Exactly. Yeah, it has less to do with the genre and more to do with the just the repetition with, you know, the heavy rotation radio.
Yeah, but I like how Hammond you zeroed in on that, because I think that's a great disco-fied track on this album.
Yeah, when I was clicking through and listening to them, I hit that and I'm like, wow, that is a sped up version of I Was Made for Loving You. All they need is the mask and the glitter capes and their kiss.
I know.
They could even keep the tartan.
So I don't know, were you puzzled when I picked this album?
So yeah, let's get into that. How come this album, Kim, of all the things that are out there, why this one?
Okay, so do you two have a history at all with the Bay City Rollers, or do you have a memory of them?
We both do from this show, but I also do from growing up. This was one of the albums that my Uncle Harry, this album wasn't, but one of the Bay City Rollers, it might have even been their greatest hits or something, my uncle had. And it was one that, you know, I think probably just focused on Saturday night was about the about the extent of it. Oh, no, looking at the album covers, it was absolutely Rock and Roll Love Letter was the album that he had and probably still has.
Yeah, and great, great power pop songs. So the Bay City Rollers were a group that I listened to a lot as a kid, and they made me happy. And I remember I went to Finland in 1978, my mom's Finnish, and they were a big hit over there. And so I had a friend in my neighborhood, too, whose big sister was shoveling the albums down to him. And for some reason, I just had really easy access to the Rollers as a kid. They were just kind of, and I was a curious record listener since I was a little kid anyway. And if there was a record, I would listen to it, but... So yeah, they were such a big hit. They were on all the Tiger Beat magazines, and Saturday Night was a big hit. Rock and Roll Love Letter was a big hit, and I remember all those. And You Made Me Believe in Magic, their It's a Game album was perhaps their most disco-friendly album. They were always flirting with disco during their big hit years. But they were one of those bands that were so huge, and their manager was abusive. And he tried to rape two of the members of the band, apparently. But just as heinous, he was a financial charlatan. And so they had a terrible experience. It was one of those classic experiences of this band is bigger than ever and everybody loves them and they're on the verge of misery. That seems to be the story. This album is the turning point where this was their growing up album, where they tried to shake they had just fired their manager, and their singer Les McKeon, who was their very much their pretty boy frontman, they kicked him out. I don't know if he left or I think they kicked him out. The stories differ, you know. And then they brought in this singer from a very cool South African band called Rabbit, with two T's on the end, who were a Bay City Rollers type band in South Africa, but they were a lot more respected as musicians. They were teeny boppers. They were kind of Beatlesque in South Africa. So they recruited one of their front men. There were kind of a Lennon McCartney leaders of this group, Rabbit. The other guy, other than Duncan Fora, who went to the Bay City Rollers, was a guy named Trevor Rabin, who ended up being, you're familiar with him. He wrote Owner of a Lonely Heart and was a member of that revival version of Yes.
Yeah, right.
A key member of Yes. So, he's a film composer. So he's done all kinds of big heavyweight, you know, Bruckheimer, what's his name? Bruckheimer films. And
Jerry Bruckheimer. And yeah, right. That was super.
Yeah.
Like prominent as a producer too. Yeah.
So yeah, Trevor Rabin was one of the members of Rabbit, and so they're a very unknown but well worth listening to band. They only did three albums, but Duncan Fora was a key member of them. So the Rollers brought him on to kind of give them songwriting muscle, and he had the advantage of also you know, he knew rock and roll. He'd been in the limousines and, you know, in that little micro world of South African rock mm-hmm. and roll. They're singing about all of these. It's a lot more meta. They're singing about actually being rock and rollers and not teeny boppers. They're singing about sex. They're singing about drugs. And they even say the word shit in one of the songs. Right. And and Eric has a mustache, God forbid, on the back cover. So this is not the teeny bopper look that they had.
Yeah, that boy band appearance.
Right, and on the front cover, there's a pill going up. You know, they're going to get high. There's a red pill on the cover. So there's all these little signifiers in the lyrics. And enough on the cover with going up into the sky, getting high in the sky, that this is not the previous Bay City Rollers. They are now the Rollers. They're growing up. And my friends and I would play air guitar to a lot of records. Or we would do air bands. ideally, we'd have four of us, and we took it as seriously as though we were actually making the music. So we would study the lyrics. So you can imagine me as a 9 or 10 year old, and we're studying the lyrics and we're making sure that we all get our parts right. The drummer is not out of sync. Mm-hmm. Background singers are actually coming in when they're supposed to and saying the right things, but we're miming.
Right.
And we did it to all of the Roller albums. We did it to Fix's Grand Illusion. We did it to Boston's, you know, debut album.
Oh, and, hilarious. And all in front of like an imaginary audience, of course.
Yep. And we actually did shows for kids in the neighborhood, air shows. Oh,
that's great.
This is a part of my experience growing up. This is how I trained to eventually start trying to make music on my own, was to mime it, and maybe all kids should do that. Well, another album we did, I remember Double Vision was a big one. Yeah, we did that whole Double Vision album. And so
for me, a similar thing was, did this with some kids I knew too, a similar thing with Freeze Frame by Jay Giles Band. And what else was it? There were a couple albums like this, but yeah, similar kind of thing. Just let's see if we could recreate these, you know, these songs. And I think I had a little cassette player and we'd record singing those songs. There's no way I had any of those things anymore, but any of those recordings anymore, but I totally remember that.
I imagine all the kids who did that internalized the music in a special way. And that's probably why you're doing all these podcasts about music, and you're probably making music. I know Hammond is making music, and it just kind of gets in your system. I think when you start to feel the music kind of deeply, I think when you're inclined to act it out, for starters, that's what my theory anyway.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think it totally is. That's funny.
So anyway, this album came out in 79 and it was part of the air guitar routine. And I was 11, just like the song on side one says, I was 11. And when I listen to this album, I think, yeah, I was 11 too. And I, this whole album, I just, it's in my DNA. And that's, you know, there's a lot of albums I could have chosen, but when I was going through, you know, I write down all the albums that I want to remember in life that I love. I have a long list of the great albums, and I could have chosen so many different ones, but this is the one where just my energy inside just rose up, and I knew I wanted to do it for this show because it reminded me of being 11. And being free. Now, I need to tell you both something. I back in 2011, I was going through a rough time in my life. Just a lot of stressful things were going on. And what I did is I'd started programming at my radio station here in Austin, the community station. And I decided I did an hour long mashup of Bay City Roller songs. You know, the Beatles album Love, where it was kind of this dream version of the Beatles history.
Yeah.
Do you remember that album?
Yeah.
The Cirque du Soleil thing where all the songs merged and.
Oh, yeah, so, totally. It was like, and they blended into one another. And yeah.
So in 2011, I took comfort in, I just hid in the nostalgia of the Bay City Rollers and did this long mashup that's my dream version with various snippets of songs from other artists that gave me context. And also the station had a rule that you couldn't play three songs in a row by the same artist, so I'd have to break it up. But it's a long mashup, and it's still one of my favorite. You know, it's some of the edits are not maybe professional sounding, but I just love how it turned out because I call it roller dream. It's my dream vision of what the Bay City Rollers meant to me. So if you want to listen to that, just out of curiosity, I mean, and it's more Bay City Rollers than anyone who's not a roller head, you know, will ask for. But it is quite a ride. And I really enjoy, I listen to it and it goes by really fast and it makes me smile. And it had the effect I needed it to have. So
I definitely want to hear that.
Okay.
This album, easily my favorite of their albums. I think when we talked about this back in the day, when we did the full Library of Bay City Rollers stuff for the show at one point, really early on, like first season, if I remember correctly.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's so great. There's a lot of cheesy stuff because they were doing the teeny really bop thing where, you know, boy and girl holding hands. And this is the album where it's who will sleep with me, they're asking, you know, rather than.
Right.
they're getting to second base, not just holding hands.
That's right.
It's such a maturity change. And like, it, you know, like you said, it's Bay City Rollers 2.0, even like you say, to the point that they dropped the Bay City, which you know, was just picked randomly on a globe, I think, by their manager at the time.
You're right.
So the fact that they're going to the Rollers, and that's what I always connect the Rollers with too, is Nick Lowe, huge fan of the Bay City Rollers, did two songs about going to the Rollers show, or did a song about going to the Rollers show. And I think even did another Bay City Rollers connected song. But
tonight I love you. When you were gone, like the
story I heard about that is he had to get out of his contract. So I don't know if you've listened to the Van Morrison album where he just rambled on about. There's a famous Van Morrison album where he just sang about anything. I wish I could remember what it was called. It's always referred to as the contractual obligation album. So he just pumped something out to get, and they never released it because they were so appalled. But Nick Lowe was apparently doing something like that. He was, I think his words in an interview where it was a jaundiced approach to the Bay City Rollers.
Oh, hilarious. Okay.
That it ended up being a big hit in Japan, and it sounds like, you know, that's what I bookend.
It's genuine.
I bookend my mashup with the Nick Lowe songs because they are so effective. But apparently he was just trying to get out of his damn contract by, well, I'm just going to do a song about the popular band and the Bay City Rollers. So what do you think about that? But he built a church for the Rollers instead of.
Wow. Oh, that's funny.
An escape route for himself. So, and then the other one, he tried to follow up on the success of it. He said, well, maybe I'm onto something. That's the story I heard. So I don't know whose story, maybe he was a big fan of them secretly.
No, it might. That does sound like something he would do, is to, you know, like, oh, I owe Stiff Records, two more singles, fine. I'll do a song about the Bay City Rollers, and it totally feels take believable.
That, Stiff. Take that, hipster Stiff.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's something about the Rollers. I was a Bay City Roller for Halloween in 1978, and we marched through the halls in our costumes. My other friend was a lot cooler. He was dressed as Ace Frehley to the nines. But I was dressed up with a tartan, you know, the bell-bottom floods with tartan patches and striped suspenders. And there's a picture on the link I sent to him. And this is one of my older blogs that I would mess around with. And I posted a picture of myself. So if you're curious, you can see me.
Totally.
My hair was not appropriately kangaroo, but... you know, you can tell by the clothes that I was a Bay City Roller, all right.
Did you ever get to see them live?
Never. No. They were, by the time, I mean, I was too much. I was a kid, and I don't even know if they even, I grew up in Salt Lake. I don't know if they ever came to Salt Lake. I really don't know. But I wouldn't have, you know, I was not in the concert-going habit at that age.
Gotcha,
but, I would have loved to have seen them. There's an interesting book written by a writer, an American girl who went to the UK and ended up being a writer for The Guardian. She wrote about her years being a Bay City Roller teenage girl fan, just, you know, living that life. And I think she even ended up being able to be a bedmate with she never says who it is. I'm guessing Woody Wood, the bassist. But she actually, her goal was less the singer, but she ended up getting into the bed a few times. But it's an interesting take. And two of the other Rollers have written memoirs. Both of them are dead. Alan and Les both wrote memoirs, and they're the two who are no longer with us.
Kilted for your pleasure.
Kilted.
For whatever reason, so listening to this again, I don't know if I appreciated it the first time we listened through it, but Washington's Birthday is a great power pop song, and it's kind of funny. Of all the holidays to pick, or you know, for a title to your song after Washington's Birthday.
This is Washington, the world. Passed you by. We know him well, and he sends you his love. Glad you called, Mrs. Washington.
Yeah, I've always been befuddled by that song. I don't know what it means, or what the deal is, but you know, the rest of the album is very much, we're going to sing about being rock and rollers. So there's Turn on the Radio, and there's it, Back on the Road Again, where the refrain is cocaine, back on the road again, cocaine. That's not what the Bay City Rollers sang about.
Stone houses,
elevator. Yeah, it's playing in a rock and roll band. That's the time tested, going all the way back to Johnny B. Goode.
Yeah.
You know, telling the story about what it's like to be a rock and roll star and what the trajectory is, and you know,
the rags to riches kind of thing. Yeah.
We keep getting songs like that, you know, Bad Company's Shooting Star, Bryan Adams, Summer of 69. There's all kinds of songs like that.
Jukebox Hero.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's just kind of the thing that a true rock and roll band is going to do is do the self-reflection, the life of touring, the life of the limousine, but that's right. All I know, and I've got to do it. And you know, so they're complaining about it in a lot of places throughout the album, the lifestyle, but they're, you know, make it clear at the very beginning that in spite of everything we may say, this is all we know and all we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Is it so a band coming off of, you know, being such a teen sensation, what do you think is the, because I know that this thing did really well critically, but But fans who were used to the teenage girl fans who were looking for the next Bay City Rolls album probably thought, oh my God, what am I listening to? This is so different. Do you think a band should do like an album that is somewhere in between before they make the music that they want to make? Or do you think this is the right method and say, no, let's see if we can find our fans kind of thing?
Yeah, I wonder about that because that audience was their bread and butter. I mean, why would you shake them? But maybe they just associated their success so much with their terrible manager and their terrible, I don't know, financial help. And maybe desperation kicks in and they think we're really going to build up a fan base. And it's what you saw you see that with a lot of teen idol bands. That is what happened with the Osmonds when they started doing Crazy Horses and really wanted to make their statement with The Plan. And then, you know, after the plan, three of the brothers got married and, you know, it was much more about financial concerns. And when they saw that, no, they weren't going to build a substantial rock audience with the nature of how they built their fame, you know, they faded just like what happened with the Rollers. They realized that, no, they're going to build a substantial male rock audience, male oriented rock audience. And the only really context I have is from that book I mentioned, the Carol Sullivan book, which could have been, you know, written a little better if you ask me. There's some fact checking problems, but she talks about being very bemused and just kind of chuckling when the Rollers tried to change their image. And you could see her remembering that as a teenager besotted with the Rollers, it was having a negative effect when the band changed, you know, when Les was gone and it was Duncan. She didn't get it, and that's probably how a lot of the audience felt.
That's too bad. I mean, you feel like a band should be able to do the music that they want to do and not have a complete culture shift and loss of their core audience if they do decide to do that. But I mean, you hear there are bands that do that kind of thing. The Beatles even went through kind of that, you know, going from Meet the Beatles and With the Beatles in those early more teen focused song albums right into things like Rubber Soul and Revolver, which were a lot more mature and a lot more and certainly regarded now as some of their best music. But
maybe they did actually ease into it, because I think the Beatles are always the model. They're the model for all rock and roll bands. And you know, the Beatles enjoyed their teeny bopper success, and they were perceived in the beginning as a band for all the young girls, but then became philosophers, you know, respected by male audience members and adults alike, you know. And so I think a band like the Rollers were just looking at their model saying, well, we're just gonna have to grow up now, and we need to start making Rubber Souls and Revolvers and Sergeant Peppers, and you know, and I think that's the dream.
Help in between
so let's skip the 65 and just go straight from 64 to 67, or I don't know.
Right. Yeah,
maybe you're
exactly,
right.
Yeah,
I think it's a tricky deal. It's clearly dealing with that level of fame. And I mentioned the Osmonds, and they're one of the bands where there was an era where you put mania after their name. There was an Osmond mania era. There was a Roller mania era, just as there was a Beatlemania era.
Right.
And you know, there were successful bands. The Bee Gees had such a big heyday in the late 70s, but you know, it was not BG mania. It was not, you know, girls dying out of the audience.
Right.
This album plays to me start to finish. I think it's just because it's in my DNA.
There's a good combination here of the nostalgia and the quality. Like, it is a quality album. It is a more evolved and more mature Bay City Rollers album, but then there's also that nostalgia when it came out, and that, you know, remembering the air guitar, remembering the performances and stuff. So one of the things we like to do is, you know, if people, hopefully they've got time to listen to the whole album. It's streaming everywhere, Spotify, Apple Music, all those places. If you want to direct people to one, let's say, hey, I've only got time to listen to one song from this album, which one do you direct them to?
Oh, that's a tough one. But I think the best intro would just be the first two songs. Stoned House is number one, merging into Elevator, because it points out where the album's going to go. But I really like Instant Relay that Hammond mentioned, because it's that acknowledgement of disco, but it's got such a, it has a unique way of expressing it, I think. And it's not even clear what he's saying. He's talking about white boy, black boy, red boy, Ayatollah. What's his point? I don't know, but, it's okay, because it's just this swirly head disco head trip in ways. And I also like Who'll Be My Keeper, which is one of Duncan's songs, because it sounds like, I don't know, it reminds me of McCartney, Oh Darling, or it reminds me of the when he would rave it up with, why don't we do it in the row? Just kind of this, you know, McCartney will occasionally do the John Lennon style slapback reverb and belt out a rocker, and that song comes right at the right moment in that style, and they're wearing their influences on their sleeve.
Brian, welcome back to the land of high fidelity.
Oh, thanks, man. Oh, my God. I'm back on my microphone. I feel so much better to be on here. Clearer sounding, you know, clearer, like, kind of like the clear feeling I get with Magic Mind. Beautiful segue. It's replaced my gallons of coffee that I used to have to drink every day to sound this fresh and on top of things.
I'll say that I used to drink, in a very real way, I used to drink so much Diet Coke that if I fell out a window, I just hit the ground and explode and fizz.
And it'd just be a foamy mess. Yeah.
And now that I've cut way back on my caffeine, and I think it has a lot to do with Magic Mind.
Yeah, it really does. And then I don't have problems sleeping and all those things. It's like, yeah, don't get me wrong, still have my coffee. As a matter of fact, I actually still have, I have my Magic Mind at the same time that I drink my coffee. So I get my coffee, and that helps kind of wake me up in the morning. But then my Magic Mind shot kind of gets me through the rest of the day. It's like a boost, a 7 or 8 hour boost that doesn't come with all the caffeine side effects.
See, and I was a tea drinker, and I still drink tea on occasion. But when I come down to start work in the morning, when I'm, you know, firing everything up for the first time, I'll crack open a Magic Mind and go from there.
Yeah. Oh, love it. And it kind of helped me with today's, you know, as we're doing this interview with Kim, it's kind of helped me to kind of recover, right? Like we're having to be focused and really think about the task at hand, the interview, and this, you got to listen to this. We can't be dealing with these or letting these issues, these sound issues and microphone and internet issues get in our way. And I feel like I owe Magic Mind a little bit of a thank you for keeping me focused on the task at hand rather than getting distracted by the technical difficulties that we may be experiencing.
Absolutely. I mean, well, the whole time you're talking to Kim about trivia, we're sending texts back and forth quietly trying to get things back online. And yeah. I mean, I'm sure.
Don't tell people how the sausage is made, Hammond.
I'm just trying to let people know that this actually, we were able to stay calm. We were able to stay focused on the task. And while we're doing that, we're trying to get you back into the world of high fidelity. And it might've been a little bumpy, but it could have been a lot bumpier if we weren't, you know, we weren't kind of on our game.
People are going to think that it was the result of your fantastic production that made it sound like we weren't fazed at all by the technical aspects of the problems we were having. However, even though you do provide fantastic production and editing. We didn't need to do any of that. Thanks to keeping on track, and owe a lot of that to not having a caffeine crash, another physical technical difficulty.
Yeah, this was in the afternoon, so it would be in that time frame where everyone kind of slows down.
Right, come down from, that would be about my come down, my post-caffeine crash where I feel like I'd need another hit of something like Diet Coke or another coffee or something like that. And with Magic Mind, I'm pretty much drinking water in the afternoons now and a little one cup of coffee in the morning instead of a gallon of it.
I got to tell you too, just the lack of cutting out caffeine, my gut feels better.
Oh yeah.
I mean, how can it not? Yeah. Right? If nothing else, I can just say that I feel well, less foamy.
Yeah. Well, it's Magic Mind's ability to synthesize ATP over the course of taking it. Listen, if you're trying it out, try it for a few days in a row and let your body synthesize that. Get in the habit of synthesizing that ATP, which can take 3 or 4 days to reach full efficacy. And better yet, get a discount. This is a great time to subscribe to Magic Mind so you get those shots on the regular. Use our code Sound20 by visiting the site magicmind.com/sound. That's short for soundography. So magicmind.com/sound and use the code Sound20, Sound20, and you'll get a combination of up to 56% off the subscription for just for the next 10 days after you hear this episode. So please go check it out.
Believe me, it's worth it.
Totally is.
You know, let's get back to talking to Kim now. I'm sure he doesn't like hearing us chat about something he's not involved in. So back to the Bay City Rollers. Oh my God,
we left Kim sitting there all alone.
Back to the Rollers.
That's right, back to the Rollers.
I lived in Germany and all we had was AFN radio. So it was one channel and they kind of catered to everybody. And so you would hear Pink Floyd and then Charlie Daniels. And then you would hear, you know, ABBA, and then you'd hear Alice Cooper. And it was just this amalgamation of 1978, 79, 80 music. And I was walking around listening to it. My first cassette that I bought was, I think it was the Flash Gordon soundtrack.
I still have that on vinyl over here.
Yeah, it was my first cassette that I ever bought with my own money. So, I mean, those kind of things stick with you.
Listening to AM radio in 1979, it reminded you how much, you know, the book I wrote was about early 70s radio and how much of a hodgepodge it was. And even though things had gotten a lot more stabilized in the FM world in the late 70s, there was still a lot of mishmash, or there's still a lot of just genre mixing up going on. And you know, that summer, I remember so clearly, you know, hearing Dance the Night Away, followed by The Devil Went Down to Georgia, you know, followed by Chucky's in Love, followed by the Knack, you know, and it was followed by Donna Summer. And it was a true representation of what was popular without regard specifically to genre.
It was, but a lot of those things were crossover hits. Like Charlie Daniels, that song could be played on both regular pop radio as well as the country stations. You go deeper on that, you maybe don't hear, you hear On the Road Again, you hear Dolly Parton's 9 to 5, things like that. But and that worked just fine on AM radio, worked just fine on the pop stations because all that stuff really did seem to fit one right after the other. But
it was the last gasp, though, for that kind of mixing up because formatting got real serious. And when you listen to FM stations, or when you look at the FM playlists from the late 70s, you see that things are getting very, very, very seriously genre divided.
Very fragmented. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the hit radio approach that you were hearing on AM in 79 was not flying on FM at all. And that's where we were headed. By the 80s, it was all adult contemporary here, hit songs there, all of a certain general ilk. And then, you know, the classic rock station, the country station, there was still crossover. always is crossover.
Sure.
But it was an interesting era. And that's where I was. This album was not a hit album at all. But it's where my head was when it came out.
Oh yeah. No, there's a reason that this thing is so critically appreciated, if not
I think in retrospect, commercially. I don't know what kind of reviews it got in the day, but I think in retrospect,
that's a really good point. Yeah.
I wonder, I would love to see. It seems like it was ignored in the day. It's like, oh, what are these guys doing?
Interesting. It's
funny because you read Rolling Stone reviews from that era and they're just very strange. You know, Paul McCartney's Back to the Egg was just destroyed by Rolling Stone.
Really, I wonder, was there a big argument just because it was so different from the things that came before? Is that the...
I think so. It's like, this is the man who wrote Eleanor Rigby. This is the man who wrote, who wrote Hey Jude. Really? And we have to listen to all of these pop confections. And, you know, you listen to McCartney now and you realize they were quite inspired. McCartney was always smoking weed and had some very I don't know. It's hard to know what he was aiming for, but they were very smart. They were always very smart. And he was always true to his whims.
Absolutely was. Easily one of the greatest pop sensibilities, like knowing what sounded great, what rhyming couplets you could put together to build a whole song around, that sort of thing. He absolutely was a master of that sort of thing.
Yeah. And he's inspirational, I think, for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
He's aware that he's not trying to write Eleanor Rigby again ever. And when you listen to him, and there are things you think, wow, this really feels like filler. There's all these other McCartney songs that he never did release that were perhaps less filler. And there's some very, very filler songs that he wisely did not release. But he's just the point about McCartney seems to be that it's always percolating all the time.
Yeah.
And anyway, so I wouldn't think Rolling Stone would have or any of those magazines would hear this album. Cream magazine might have appreciated it.
Sure.
But they like to make fun of everything too.
And, Rolling Stone probably would have been more on the like saying, "Ooh, what our audience is going to want to hear us to say about this album?" Probably it as well. Yeah,
tongue will be in cheek with Cream most likely.
Right.
But I'd be curious, but yeah, it is. I always have had a thing for this album and their attempt. Now as the older I get, I feel a little. I even feel more compassion for what they were trying to do with their grown up image. This is the only Rollers album that had the lyrics on the sleeve. I think I've got the album in my hand right now.
Interesting.
There it is. All the lyrics. You can see it all.
I wonder what the I know this is the we're getting into the weeds on this part, but I wonder what the decision is on from record companies on whether or not to include the lyrics. How much of the band's decision is that, and how much is it of no, we really want to put more pictures of the band. We know that's what's selling albums, so we want to have more pictures of you guys in here and not the lyrics, that sort of thing. I wonder where that decision comes from.
Yeah, I do wonder about that. Clive Davis was the guy who understood the Rollers when they were making it big in the UK, and he helped craft their image for the US and made sure that Saturday Night would be a single, and he had good ears, and it was a number one single. And that's by December 75, it was very clear that Roller Mania was on, and Saturday Night was a monster hit.
Oh, massive.
They were still on Arista, and maybe Clive Davis was still humoring the band and saying, let's keep crafting an image then. And obviously he was going along with it. There are five pictures of the band members on the back, but then it's all the sleeve. And you would think that there would still be reason to show them in Tiger Beat style, a lot of pictures and full body and colors, but they clearly had more say in the matter.
Yeah,
and interesting. Maybe they were just leaving them alone. Maybe Clive Davis and company were just saying, all right, let's ride this out. Let's fulfill your contract.
Right. How many albums did they have after this one? Did they do? They did a few more, actually.
More. One called Vox and one called Ricochet. And there are good moments on those albums. Some you can hear in my mashup, of course. Mm-hmm. The mashup I did was chronological. So you can hear some of those if you don't want to dip into the whole album. I think some other people might feel like one of the other two albums was better than this one, but I really think this is the special one. And I think they were trying to, recapture the magic of this one with the other two Rollers albums.
Sure. Sure.
But they were done by 1981. Okay. It was all over.
So yeah,
contract this was fulfilled and
we've done our time, right?
And interestingly enough, Duncan Fora, who was there, the guy they brought in from Rabbit, and actually I should mention Hello and Welcome Home was a song on the Rabbit, their third Rabbit album, and they reworked it for this one. That's very nerdy stuff to point out, but there it is.
That is interesting.
Duncan Fora had a pretty nifty 80s song, a very guilty pleasure type song on the Who's That Girl soundtrack.
Oh, really? Under his own name, or was he part of another band? Name.
Yeah, and it's called 24 Hours. And it's a very catchy, lovable hit sounding song that was not a hit, but it was on the soundtrack.
I'll have to go look for that one too. Is that in your mashup by chance?
No, that did not make it. That came on my radar after the mashup.
Gotcha.
It would have been fun. You know, I could really go to town and get extremely nerdy with a revised mashup. But I don't know. Check that out because it's very, very, it's a very likable song in my opinion.
Will do. Yeah, I was curious what happened. Like if the, again, probably something we talked about 5 years ago, whatever it was that we did that episode about the Rollers. But if any of them went on to be members of other bands or do solo stuff that was of note. And sounds like that's a great example right there, being on the soundtrack to a Madonna movie.
I guess that was his last big, you know, international moment. And then it was just doing stuff on his own, wherever he was based. Maybe he was back in South Africa, but it's clear when you look at YouTube, you know, when you look at YouTube clips of Rabbit and of Duncan, you see that he was a real heartthrob in his day.
Yeah.
He was really something.
I'll try not to get distracted by that when I go to listen to music.
Right. Try not to just take it. But it's very ambitious. It's you know, the Rabbit albums are worth checking out.
Cool.
Because they really were trying. They were really going for the pop craft. Borderline prog, kind of song constructions that Queen liked to do, sort of less simple but very well. Duncan Fora was a very solid songwriter. He knew what he was doing, and they were smart to bring him on. You know, he gave them chops. He gave them muscle, and it's too bad it didn't. It wouldn't have been great if the Rollers would have taken off and redefined themselves.
Yeah,
but it was not to be.
The world just wasn't ready for the Rollers.
Well, you see the album cover. Of the Ricochet album cover, their last album, they're all dressed in these different outfits. It's like, no, we're going to look like this. No, we're going to look like that. And you could just see, these guys are going to collapse before you even hear the album. And the music actually comes through a little better than what the album cover suggests. Cause you see that and you think, wow, this is going to be such a stretch and such a painful effort on their part. Oh, yeah. The way they're trying so hard to look, you know, contemporary. That's funny though.
Yeah, for sure. Looking at it right now, you could easily show this as a rock pile or, you know, some other power pop group from the 80s and convince me that it was not the Bay City Rollers or in this case, just the Rollers.
Yeah. You could do that kind of game. You could play this for someone and say, do you know who this is?
Yeah.
Can you guess who this is? And they wouldn't know. Like we just, this the standard music listener.
Right.
You know, the standard music listener who's aware of the eras and has been tuned in since the 70s or whatever. I don't know.
Well, we're probably about the time limit that that we have for this, but Kim, once again, I want to thank you for coming on the show and putting out such a great cover album that I've enjoyed so much, and for bringing this album, kind of reintroducing us to Elevator after we'd kind of forgotten about it, and maybe introducing it to an audience here that's listening to Soundography that may just think of the Bay City Rollers as that band that did Saturday Night.
Yeah. Well, it's my pleasure. And it's, you know, thanks for humoring me. This is such a great opportunity for me to rave about an album that I don't always have opportunities to rave about. So
no, we really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed having you.
You two are very gracious. So thank you.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Hammond, anything you want to say to close us out?
I just wanted to see if Kim had any social media stuff you wanted to point people at before we roll out.
Well, maybe this will prompt me to be a little better about social media. I tend to have long stretches where I'm not really on it. But I do have a Facebook presence of sorts. So find me there. I also have my website, so you can reach me through that, kimsimpson.us.
Excellent.
And I keep things reasonably. It's a very rudimentary kind of website, but it gets the job done.
Lets people know where they can hear more of your music and if you're going to be doing any live shows, things like that.
Yeah, all that stuff. And I'm doing, you know, I do my radio show every single week. It's international folk music, which is very different.
Oh yeah.
From the Rollers, but I have a lot of energy and digging out these kinds of what I call global roots music. And it's a fun show and I love doing it. I've been doing it since 2009 or so here in Austin. So, and you can hear it online every Wednesday at noon.
Oh, it feels like such a wide range of music just in that description, international folk music. I imagine there's so many varieties, so many places that can go. I have to check that out now.
It's what I love about it. It just has a lot of different directions you can turn.
Excellent. So. Excellent. Well, Kim, thank you so much. And listeners, thank you guys so much for tuning in. And make sure to go check out Elevator by The Rollers and enjoy it. Let us know what you think. And we'll see you next time for another You Gotta Listen to This right here on Soundography.